Morning, everyone. We have a full schedule today, and so we're going to be working fairly quickly through it. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3069. This will be a tap-tap hearing, so we are going to open the hearing and close the hearing on House Bill 3069. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2649, and is Jim Welsh here? Nope. We were hoping for an update on this bill, but since the presenters are not in the room, we will close the work session on 2649. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3174.
Want to do the first?
Okay.
No, they're still signing up.
They're still signing up. All right. People are still signing up. We will recess that one for now. We'll go to House Bill 2627. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2627 prohibits falsely advertising as or otherwise purporting to be a licensed or to make electrical installations or purporting to be an acting as a business making electrical installations. Thank you.
Jared Broadfoot.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications. Here today representing the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This bill is an IBEW bill, and currently in the plumbing statutes, we have the same language, and we noticed during the interim that the electrical statutes did not have the same language. So the idea behind the bill is that we protect the consumers so that someone that is not a licensed electrician does not advertise or tell people that they can do licensed work. So like we said, we just took the language from the plumbing statutes and moved it over to the electrical statutes. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Jared, how often do you have this case happen in your you said plumbing?
Since we've had the statute over in the plumbing statutes, we've seen it less, but we still see advertisements, for example, Joe's Plumbing or Joe's electrician that he can do all of this work, and you call him up and he says, oh sure, I can do that, but in reality, he cannot do it since he's not a licensed electrician or plumber. So I think in the plumbing statutes it's definitely helped.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2627. Let's get out of work session on that one. Tend to bring that one back. All right, can we go ahead and start that? Okay, we're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3174. We now have the sign-up sheet. Have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3174 provides for payment to contractors and subcontractors on construction projects, requires a 30-day billing cycle for construction contracts, provides exceptions to alternate billing, requires owners to approve or decline to approve a bill within 14 days to make payment within 7 days following approval. It specifies the grounds for owners to decline to approve a certain cost, requires the contractor to make payment to subcontractors within 7 days of receiving payment from owner, prescribes an interest penalty for unpaid amounts. It specifies the grounds for a contractor or subcontractor to suspend work on contract or terminate contract, and provides that construction contract may not be subject to the law of another state. Thank you.
Call Dan O'Brien and Rick Thomas. Morning,
Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Thomas, Executive Director of Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon, representing the state's Merit Shop Electrical and Communications Contractors. We're here this morning in support of House Bill 3174, which ensures contractors and subcontractors in the state receive prompt, timely payment on construction contracts. As people will testify, Mr. O'Brien here to my right, construction contracts in the state are often paid in a bit slow process. Slow economy contractors are faced with a difficult decision, working not knowing if they'll get paid timely or paid at all. While most choose we'll choose work over not working, it's a bit of a gamble in some cases for contractors. These problems are a result of project owners often being slow in paying general contractors. When general contractors don't get paid, I think it's safe to assume that down the food chain that there can be a negative impact on subcontractors as well as material suppliers within the state. House Bill 3174 does two things. It creates a uniform process and adds simplicity to the way that public contracting and private contracting is done. It creates a process to tell owners that they will pay contractors for their work that's done in a satisfactory manner on a set timeline. This way the general contractor knows that he or she will be paid for the work that's not in dispute in a certain number of days. Next, timelines are set for subcontractors to be paid, again knowing that they will be paid in a certain number of days for work that was done in a satisfactory manner. In the case of simplicity, it creates one process. Regardless if it's a public project or a private project in the state, there's one process for payment, one set of timelines, one set of penalties, and everybody needs to know only one process for billings and for payment. However, the bill also recognizes that there are going to be times when one size does not fit all. When this is the case, it provides an alternative process so that whether it be a private owner or a public owner, they can set separate timelines in their project as long as it's clearly identified on each page in the contract that a separate process is going to be used under it. Also, if once during the project a separate process is needed, it sets, again, a process in place so that an alternative process can be used as long as each of the contractors and subcontractors within the project agree to the new process and consent to it. Everything's fine. It can be switched. As far as penalties go, this bill does also put some teeth behind what it's hoping to accomplish. Owners or general contractors who don't meet timelines will have a set amount of interest at 1.5% per month or fraction thereof that they'll be expected to pay. Contractors will also be able to go into a process where they'd be entitled attorney's fees or a loser pays type of a system for things that are in dispute. And we basically view that this would be good for business. It again creates one process where everybody knows what the timelines are, knows what the expectations are. It's a bit of a new process. We know some people will be a little bit uneasy with switching to something that's new or different that they haven't been used to. However, we feel that there's enough of a give and take within this bill that you can use alternative processes if you need to and notify the contractors that these can be worked around. We hope that you'll support creating this one uniform process, and we'd appreciate your support of this bill.
Thank you.
Chairman Close, representatives, my name is Dan O'Brien. I am president of Kern Electrical Construction Company and a member of the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. I will tell you, however, that my remarks are based on experience with the Associated General Contractors of America. I sat on their executive board for the last 2 years and served as chairman of their Specialty Contractor Council, where we've had the opportunity to discuss this issue of payment for the last 18 years. This is the one topic that causes the most anguish in the construction industry, and it's called payment. When you get your credit card at home, you have the opportunity to go through and check off and review everything that you actually looked at or that you actually purchased during that year, write the check, and get it done normally within a 25-day period of time. In most cases, it's much faster than that. In the construction industry, you sign a contract, pay for your permit, start your work, and then on the 25th or the 30th of the month, you submit your bill for the work completed in that month, understanding you've got 22 working days already completed and you haven't been paid for anything as of yet. And if you've been fortunate enough to have filled out your payment request correctly and submitted it on the exactly right date and sometimes the exact right time, you may get paid within 30 to 65 days after that period of time. The 25th of the next month, you do the same thing. You still haven't been paid for the first month that you've actually worked on this project, and you basically fill out the same form, send them in. In the case of our company, it's an average of 42 days after we submit our bill, and understand that that's basically 64 days that we have in process that we haven't been paid for anything on a construction project. In our company, for the 54th day in question, which we haven't been paid as of yet, it costs us $223,140, and we're a less than $3 million contractor. That is a tremendous amount of capitalization for small and large contractors have out there without having any guarantee that you're going to get paid on any specific day. This may sound like a long story, but in fact it's the truth and is exactly what's happening in the construction industry. Essentially, the issue is twofold. The issue of payment is the most common cause of litigation in the construction industry. Whether it be private or public work, the issue of non-payment or slow payment is a constant source of consternation. The constant litigation creates negative images for our industry. We're always fighting with each other in public and sometimes on public projects. The primary issue of payment has been determined to be a problem between the general contractor and the owner. And actually, it's an owner problem. A survey of our specialty contractors, of which we have 14,000 of them, 72% came back and said that it was an owner problem and primarily a communication problem between the general contractor and the owner. And as a result, the general contractor and the subcontractor have a problem on that specific project. The general contractor is a primary motivator when it comes to payment. He sets the terms and conditions via the subcontract for the subcontract submission, including when, how, and how many copies you sent in. The general contractor is also working for an owner who, if it's all successful, he may want to work for again, and that's a key element in this process. Therein lies part of the problem. The general contractor is likely to give up a couple of days in his negotiations on payment to keep the owner happy for future opportunities versus the negative impact of construction industry cash flow. Even if the contractor is strict on his adherence to contract terms and conditions, sometimes his ability to enforce those terms and conditions is balanced on the marketing effort for future work with the owner. By the way, the specialty contractor does the same thing with the general contractor for the opportunity to go out and look for future work, and that affects the food chain directly down the line. If a specialty contractor wants to ask about the owner's ability to pay, in particular on private projects, but we know that the government in most cases is going to pay their bills, but to ask about the ability to pay, the general contractor is reluctant to give up the information to get direct access to the owner. I mean, he doesn't want 200 specialty contractors contacting the owner to find out if this guy can really pay his bills. And then that becomes a real problem because the specialty contractor steps up to the table and actually wants to price a project, but he doesn't know if this guy can really pay his bills, he doesn't know when he's going to pay his bills, and he doesn't know how long he's going to have to dip into his line of credit to keep his company afloat before this owner makes his check. If there are 500 commercial, industrial, and heavy or highway general contractors in this state, there are 500 different forms of subcontracts that the specialty contractors have to sign. And this is part of the problem, is the fact there's no uniform specialty subcontract out there, and as a result, we're having to look through every term and condition, and payment becomes a real issue when we finally get to the point of constructing a project. It is my belief that House Bill 3174, with some minor modifications, will help alleviate a significant number of the issues mentioned above. House Bill 3174 places in concrete the time schedule for payment on private and public work construction projects. It allows the owner an opportunity to inform the construction contractors bidding, pricing, and negotiating the project about changes in terms and conditions of the payment on that specific project. And that's the key element. We got to know how we're going to be paid so we can price the project effectively and put the cost of money in our construction contract at the same time. House Bill 3174 allows the general contractor and the specialty contractor the opportunity to make informed decisions about the terms and conditions on that project. It removes the marketing aspect of the general contractor working with the owner and the specialty contractor working with the general contractor. It specifically outlines the course of action that a general contractor and or a specialty contractor may take if he or she is not paid on that project in question. Arizona has a bill that's very similar to this. Actually, it's been in place for 2 years. It was supported by the majority of major owners in that area. Talk about Intel, Raytheon, Motorola, some of the bigger people that build bigger buildings and the larger general contractors in the state. In the 2 years in operation, it's actually working very well. They've done a good job of it. Everybody's been patient watching the law work and come into place. But if we get the opportunity to step to the plate and put prompt payment on the table and put it into law, the state of Oregon is going to realize a benefit of this too. The payment of taxes and the things we do and the better profitability of our contractors and subcontractors out there give us the opportunity to pay a few more taxes and support this great state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, questions for the panel? Thank you very much. We'll call Jessica Harris and John Killen. And Scott Byrd.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. I'm here today in support of this bill, however, with some conditions. AGC agrees very much with the intent of this bill and with the goal that it seeks to achieve. We concur that many of the problems in the construction industry and many of the squabbles that we find ourselves in litigation and our Full Employment Lawyer Act tend to be about payment and concerns about who got paid on time and for what and when and under what conditions. Mr. O'Brien is very much correct. This is a major issue for our industry. A few years ago in 1999, this legislature passed a prompt payment act for the public side of the house. And so the public work, there is a process and a procedure and a set of penalties. And everyone largely knows what those are, cumbersome though they may be. This bill tries to put those two together and make those work for both public and private work. AGC does have concerns both on some technical things, an effective date that isn't going to work quite right, some definitional stuff that we have issue with, and then some broader reaching stuff on how language is constructed that we think may leave room open for litigation. For example, in 4.2, very, very broad language that doesn't make it clear the structure of general contractor to subcontractor material suppliers and how tiered work and who has what relationship to whom, for example, what a material supplier is, that kind of thing. All of these issues are resolvable. We have appreciated the sponsor's willingness and effort to work with us. We have received assurances that these issues will be addressed either here or on the Senate side, and we are more than willing to be at their pleasure and at your pleasure at when and where the right place is to do that. Again, we support this bill and look forward to working with them to resolve their concerns at the appropriate time and place. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning, committee members. I guess Chair Kitts for the moment.
I appreciate that.
My name is John Killen. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Associated Builders and Contractors here in Oregon. We are also here in support of House Bill 3174. We strongly believe this is a good bill and we should move forward with it. We're happy to work with AGC on their concerns and will do our best to fix those concerns and move forward. It's become apparent over the last several years that this sort of legislation is necessary. We need to provide guidelines for payment in construction contracting. Contractors and laborers from around the state can share anecdotes and the trouble caused by the lack of guidance in this area. Prompt payment, as it's been mentioned, prompt payment provisions have been here in Oregon for public projects for a few years now, and they seem to be increasing the reliability of payment. Our bill would provide revisions to the public contracting prompt pay provisions and new law for private construction. It's time to encourage standard and regular payment periods for hardworking businesses and laborers to keep Oregon building. You can see, along with my written testimony, a short summary of what we feel the bill does. It kind of gives you the basics of what's there. With that, I will. You've heard most of the stories, and so I'll let us move on here and ask for your support.
Good morning. My name is Scott Bray. I represent Northwest Electrical Specialties. for a mid-sized mechanical and electrical subcontractor. What I found in contracting is one of the few businesses that someone comes and borrows money from you and we sign their contract. It's like going to the bank and wanting to borrow money, and the banker gives you money, and then you give him your contract to sign, and he's supposed to let us pay him on the terms we choose. Because a lot of owners and general contractors tend to rely on subcontractor financing, it puts a burden on the subs, and it does put a burden on the general contractors. In particular, I kind of figured out what some of the costs are of this subcontractor and contractor financing are. The typical contractor making profit will make 2-3% profit a year. By subcontractor financing, based on our receivables have been 45 to 48 days. That cost to us is around $17,000 a year in interest. That relates to maybe a third of a percent of interest. But last year, because of the post 9/11 problems, for some reason, payment became very slow. Our collection process was at 77 days. This means we had to carry our contracts, our projects, for an extra month's time. Besides, we'd already were waiting 45 days, which is really about 60 days of collection period. This would mean that it would, if you were to make a profit, it would take one-third of your gross profit or net profit off the contract. So basically, you're working four months out of the year to finance the owners and the GCs. An example that we had last year was a job called Northwest Traffic Signal. There was a problem with getting paid. The financing wasn't in place because a lot of times owners will get people started on the job and will not have financing in place. We had to wait several months to get the money. The money was so late that because we have to pay our vendors when we get paid, because when you're out 30, 60 days, that means you may have hundreds of thousands of dollars out. You've got payroll out, withholdings out, which are due the following pay period, benefits, and at that, we were charged late fees from a vendor of $1,900, which we were never able to collect. That vendor doesn't even want to work with us because we don't have the capital to finance, you know, carry their projects 3, 4, 5, 6 months on the job. So that was a pretty tough impact on us. Another thing, if we can get notification when the payment's made, then we get to be assured that the owner is paying their bill. A lot of owners do want to pay their bills. They do want the subcontractors paid because at the end they want all the liens released. But occasionally we do get the excuse that no, the payment hasn't been made, it's not going to be made, there's some problem, whatever. Well, we've had two examples of that last year. We worked a job in Portland, Fire Station 12 and Washington County 911, and same situation. They of course they weren't paid. No, never received any money. And usually by contract, we're not really allowed to go to the owner. Well, it got so desperate, we went to them anyway. Come to find out, payments had been made, and the contracting officers did help us get paid. They immediately notified the general contractors, and we were paid. I feel that the owner loses any protection paying his bills on time. The financing is already should be in place anyway before they allow construction work to start. They do have protections through performance and payment bonds and retainages and a number of other lien releases. That's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jessica, would the provisions of this bill apply to a homeowner having remodeling done on their own house as the owner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe so.
Follow up. The reason I ask that is that a 7-day period for payment of a bill seems really like a very short time frame compared to what people are expected to pay on any other bill that they get. I mean, just a week from the time that you receive a bill seems like an incredibly short payment period.
Madam Chair, it is, as I understand this bill, it is
14 days after you approve and certify payment. However, I can tell you that this bill was not intended, as I understand it, again, the agency is not the sponsor of this legislation, but from the sponsors that I've talked to, it's not the intent of this legislation necessarily to apply to the average homeowner that's doing a remodel or even constructing a home. It's intended to apply to commercial construction projects, but I could be wrong about that, so I'm going to look to ABC here so they can answer that question.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I agree. It was meant to hit commercial side of things as much as possible. You would have a total of 21 days to pay the bill. Since we will be taking a look at AGC's concerns as well, we will be sure to research the bill and make sure we aren't infringing on some homeowner rights of any kind.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Well, my concern is that we seem to be casting a really broad net in this bill. And would you be open to amending the bill in a way that would make it clear that it was only applying to this commercial, larger project, not the individual homeowner situation?
AGC certainly would, Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, ABC would probably be open to that as well.
Thank you very much. Call Bill Boyd. And Bill is with the Construction Contractor Board.
Chair Close, members of the committee, we kind of didn't anticipate this hearing this morning. We have the board has not taken a position on this bill per se. That's why I put myself down as neutral. However, we were asked to prepare a fiscal impact statement for this bill due by noon, and we do believe it will have some impact because it does make, on page 4, it makes the CCB responsible for carrying out disciplinary actions for violations of the bill. We're still looking at that. I can't tell whether that's going to be a large impact. We have had an increasing impact of the a similar bill that applies to public contracts, and some of these cases recently have involved fairly extensive hearings and work with our assigned attorney general. So in the scheme of things compared to our entire budget, I can't really tell you how much that impact will be, but we're looking at it. We'll have an answer quite quickly. That's all I have to say. I'm free to answer any questions you wish.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, that concludes the testimony on this bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3174, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3174.
Madam Chair,
Representative Kitts.
I would move that we accept House Bill 3174 and move it to the floor of the DuPage recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3174 to the floor with a DuPage recommendation. The drafters of the bill have agreed to address some of the concerns. We've decided, because of the time constraint with Senate committees beginning to shut down in first part of May, that we would like to move the bill through. So that is the intent of this motion discussion. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I fully appreciate that we're on a strict timeline. My concern about this bill, though, is that it does seem like it needs really significant changes, and though I fully accept that probably some of that will happen on the Senate side, I'm uncomfortable voting yes on the bill today, particularly my concerns about residential homeowners being caught in the net that I don't think this bill was intended to catch, and also just how short some of the time frames seem to be for moving bills through. So, I mean, bills for the work, not our bills.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. I want to share my concerns. I'm not a lawyer. I might even have a conflict of interest on this, but I've had to chase people around for money before, and so I definitely agree with the intent, but I too share my concerns for the expeditious way we're doing it. I just wanted to voice that concern, please. Thank you.
We'll bring Sean Miller forward to address these concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. You know, a lot of these issues have just emerged this morning, and we apologize for not being able to address some of these. And the bill is not intended to deal with the homeowner. I think some of the concerns that were raised, we would be willing to obviously, you know, take a little bit of time in this committee and address some of those issues before we move the bill. Obviously, time is something that is not on our side right now, and we would we are willing to hold the bill and work it and alleviate some of the concerns on the committee, which I see, and I think we can move this bill, and it'd be supported by again, this is a bill that's supported by the entire industry. It's important for our industry. And I think some of these technical amendments can be drafted in a very short time frame.
So your intent would be to do it on the House side then?
We can do that, yeah. Because I think a lot of these issues, I don't think they are substantial. I think they're very, a lot of these are easily fixable in a short amount of time. Thanks, Madam Chair.
So can I ask you, we will intend then to schedule a new work session. Okay. Wednesday? Can you do it that quickly?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay, Representative Kitts withdraws his motion to move the bill. We will intend to have a work session on Wednesday on this bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3174. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2952 and have the staff read the summary. And Paul Romain can come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2952 requires the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Affairs to order application of similar premium classification or create special classification for employer when workers' compensation rates are unfairly discriminatory under certain circumstances. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, committee. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Welcome to the wonderful arcane world of workers' compensation. It's an interesting area. I've been practicing law for 31 years, even though I'm only 32 years old, and it is something I still don't understand.
Madam Chair, don't we have something that says they have to tell the truth?
We're going to disregard that.
Okay. So that was my lie for the day. Not on the number of years I've been practicing law. I'm going to read from you the part of ORS 737310, which is the first part of the bill, 2952. This is existing law. It says, rates shall not be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. Now, that applies generally across the board. The problem is that unfairly discriminatory really isn't defined. So what we do at the end of the bill, in 17, the new language, is we define what unfairly discriminatory is. And basically, it's in regard to a particular employer, if the rate in material part contemplates coverage for risks or hazard under a particular job classification or descriptions that do not reasonably reflect the particular employer's operations or allocations of responsibilities. In other words, if the rates really don't apply. Now, this, as most cases around here, this legislation arises out of a case that's currently going on, where the administrative law judge who heard the case, this was Lemma Wine Company, and I'll go into the facts in a second, the conclusion of the administrative law judge in his proposed order was that the rate was unfairly discriminatory, excessive and unfairly discriminatory. Let me go back. There used to be two classifications, for one for beer and ale distributors and one for wine distributors. And basically all these people in 1999 were brought under one classification for beer, ale, in other words, all the beer and wine distributors, all those represented on my tie. The rate does not reflect the different jobs that are within those particular distributors. For example, you have a number of distributors, particularly in wine, where the salespeople do not touch any product. They just sell the product. They take orders for the product. They don't do any lifting. There's no warehouse. There's no driving. There's no nothing. And what happened to the wine distributors in particular is their rates went skyrocketing because of this. They were lumped in with beer distributors. Now, this is a special Oregon class code, 7390, generally. The basic manual for NCCI, which is the rating bureau, says the purpose of the classification system is to group employers with similar operations so that the assigned classification reflects the exposures common to those employers and the rate charge reflects the exposure to loss common to those employers. The problem, I'll get to the final order, the general the administrative law judge again found that the particular rate was unfairly discriminatory. The insurance administrator overruled, now the case is at the Court of Appeals, but what they found was that although according, I'll read from this, since Code 7390 specifically includes outside salespeople, which are people who do lift things, we cannot apply the general classification of salespeople to the particular business because some outside salespeople are classified under this code. We can't include everybody. Or we have to include everybody. They say when a classification specifically includes outside salespersons, it includes all outside salespersons. Accordingly, although beer and ale distributors and wine salespersons who ride in the delivery trucks and take orders and make receipt collections fall within 7390, which we agree with, other salespeople who do not perform these activities for such beverage distributors are included in this classification. They already found that it unfairly discriminates, yet they felt they were without power. They have to keep this general classification. So all of these salespeople, even the ones who never see a vehicle, never touch, pick up any of this product, are all classified as such. And again, it greatly increases the rate. All we do in 2952 is define a little bit what the language in the statute already says. We looked at different options. One of the options we contemplated was mandating statutorily a different classification. We felt that was improper. It's not the legislative role. It's NCCI's role. But the legislature did tell them to say if it's unfairly discriminatory, then use something different. Now, what you'll hear from the opposition to this is it creates a little bit of chaos. If every employer basically can come up and say, we don't like this particular rate because it doesn't apply to our particular situation. But what I'll tell you right now is you already have that. We're at the Court of Appeals. You already have within the law language which says rates shall not be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. If they find that something's unfairly discriminatory, and the one who heard the facts, the administrative law judge, found that it was unfairly discriminatory, why wouldn't they order some kind of rate change to reflect that discrimination and to allow for the lower rate? This gives a little bit of discretion, doesn't mandate anything, gives a little bit of discretion. We would appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, thank you for your testimony. And on the third page of the bill, it notes that if the director finds that a rate is unfairly discriminatory, so on and so forth, the director shall mitigate the impact by ordering the application of another similar premium classification. Can you address both the words similar to what and why it's a premium classification, necessarily a premium classification?
Madam Chair, sorry, Representative Merkley, sorry. Well, that was a big one.
No problem.
It's early in the morning, and I'm falling asleep here now. There are two classifications. I'm trying to get the numbers here for you. There are two classifications that were at issue in this particular case. One of them is 7390, which covers all beer, ale, and now wine distributors. That's the general classification. There is a separate classification for salespeople. It's 8742. And what happens is that separate salesperson classification, which is considerably cheaper, covers all outside salespeople. But only if salespeople are not covered within the general classification of 7390. Our position is that you have two different kinds of salespeople. You have those that go out in the trucks and actually touch the product, who would be covered in 7390. You have those who don't ever see a truck. They don't ever see the product. That should be separate. There is already a separate classification, 8742, which would cover them. And what the administrative law judge had said is...
Just about to come up.
The administrative law judge had said that 8742 should, and that would be the fair way to handle it, cover these kinds of people. What the insurance folks said is no, since some salespeople are covered under 7390, all salespeople have to be covered under 7390. We feel that's unfairly discriminatory. You already have a rate that you could just say, plug in right here. It cuts the rate to the employer considerably, doesn't touch the employees at all, doesn't hurt them at all. In fact, it helps because it helps the employer retain more employees. So we would appreciate your support.
Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I have to excuse myself to go testify, but the reason I asked about that, I'm very sympathetic to this issue, having run into it myself previously, but when you get outside the specific case that you're addressing, this language needs to be broad enough or understood well enough to address any potential case that might be brought under it. And when I read this ordering the application of another similar premium classification, it raised the question to me, similar in what ways? Similar to the classification that exists currently, similar in the line of work, similar in the rate, obviously, is not what you're looking for. So that was just a question about drafting.
Chair Representative Merkley, I sympathize with it. We were trying to give the insurance folks as much discretion as possible to be fair, basically. And all we're saying is look at your classifications. If there's something that really applies better, don't just lump everybody together. Apply something that makes a little more sense. We're not trying to mandate anything. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll call Mike Taylor, John Booten, and John Schultz. Good morning.
Chairman Close, committee members, my name is Mike Taylor. I'm the State Relations Director for the National Council on Compensation Insurance, and I'm here to testify in opposition to 2952. Without going through all the details, NCCI collects, manages workers' compensation statistics, and one of the big issues, one of the big parts of that is the development and maintenance of the workers' comp classification system. We believe the proposals contained in Section 17 of this bill are redundant and unnecessary in light of the current authority and historical practices of the director of the DCBS. Through the Oregon Classification Review and Advisory Committee, the Audit Appeals Unit, or the Hearings Division, the director has ordered new classifications for specific industries, amended the application of existing classifications, and created new classifications for individual employers in Oregon. This has been accomplished by reviewing the operations, the hazards, the exposures of an employer or an industry on a case-by-case basis. Nationally, the workers' compensation system uses approximately 650 classifications. Many states have amended or added to this list due to the unique circumstances within that jurisdiction. Oregon has been a leader in this area with over 150 state special classifications, rules, or interpretations. This includes such diverse areas as adult community care facilities, farming operations, and restaurants. We feel that this method of review and oversight by the director has served the Oregon employers and the workers' compensation insurance industry well. Adding another layer of regulation to this process will remove the director's flexibility and will not be a benefit to the system. Accordingly, we would request the committee to reject House Bill 2952. Thank you, and I'll be glad to answer any questions the committee may have.
Mike, I guess I have one question. You said it was redundant and unnecessary, and then we've had testimony that the administrative law judge found against them in this case.
And you say that the director of DCBS already has this authority, so why would the administrative law judge go against them on that decision?
Without knowing all the facts of the appeal, I couldn't say other than the law that this appeal did go through the local advisory committee to be reviewed first, was appealed there, and then appealed to the hearings officer or the ALJ. And I don't know all the facts of the case, and I haven't read the decision, so I can't tell you why they rejected it. But they have the option at both levels and the continuing level at the court case to overrule that if they felt it was necessary.
The director does?
The director does, okay. Yes, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Gordon.
Mr. Taylor, how many new classifications have been created over the past, let's say, 5 years?
In Oregon or nationally?
Give me a comparison if you have them.
Chairman Close, I would say nationally we've created probably 25 new classifications in a national basis, or interpretations of existing classifications where you take a current code and you say, how does it apply? Has industry changed? What has gone on within that industry that we need to change both the application of that classification or just how it's being applied?
Follow?
Follow.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said about Oregon.
Madam Chairman, Representative. Oregon is probably about 15 to 20 new classifications or interpretations of existing classifications over that same time frame.
Thank you very much.
Okay. John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Booten, the Ombudsman for Small Business of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here in opposition to House Bill 2952. You may find that somewhat surprising in that I am an advocate for businesses, but a major part of my job is to try to keep those businesses out of trouble with workers' compensation. And since Mr. Taylor has covered it adequately, I'm just going to zero in on one point that I find particularly troubling. It's the last item in the bill. It offers two remedies. The one is a similar classification. The second one is a unique classification for that employer. And the simplest way I can say that is that's self-insurance. When you define a classification for that employer, you've created a unique pricing mechanism for that employer. And anybody that could afford to carry their own classification is probably already self-insured. I don't know any small business that could. In fact, I'll share a couple of horror stories with you that I encountered through the years. Unlike Mr. Romaine, I'm not an attorney, but I've practiced classification for 34 years, and I do understand classification. And through that period of time, I've seen the case of building wrecking, where they wanted relief from part of their operation because they thought it was not as hazardous as knocking buildings down. And in about 2 years, the rate for building wrecking was over $100 per $100 of payroll, because only the most hazardous work was left in the classification. High-rise window washing had a similar experience. They didn't want, when they were on the ground, they didn't want to pay the rate they paid when they were up on the scaffold. So they tinkered around with their classification, and soon its rate was over $100 per $100 of payroll. Needless to say, it was tough to get your windows washed during that period of time. Sure. So tamper with it carefully. It's a structure that is the basis for all of the pricing and workers' compensation. And it's the system by which we gather the statistics to make those rates, and they're charged Oregon employers. So I would caution you to err on the side of conservatism and just drop B out entirely, because it's not a workable premise, and it is self-insurance. Thank you for your attention. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
John, I guess my question is, I don't see this bill as tampering so much as giving authority and flexibility to your office. Did your office get involved with this administrative decision that was made?
I used to be involved with the ALJs, but since they made them a separate panel, any communication I have with them now is ex parte. So
is that true of the whole department?
Well, yes, it is. In fact, they take the case out of the department, hear it at that panel, and then send it back to the department, and the administrative insurance division reviews it, and if he has a different opinion, then he writes the final order to differ with the ALJ.
So I guess I'm unclear why you wouldn't want your department to have a little more authority in those cases.
I don't want anybody to have the authority to create unique classifications for an employer. I mean, it is self-insurance. You could have a $5,000 premium employer who's unhappy with their class. You create a unique classification. All of the statistics that go into that classification to make future rates are coming from one $5,000 premium employer. and we don't allow self-insurance at that level.
Beyond the question of self-insurance, though, do you see a difference between physical labor and office jobs in terms of workers' comp coverage?
Sure. But again, it's not the apparent hazard. I'm sorry, Chairman Close. It's not apparent hazard that drives rates. Rates are based on experience. The example I use when I'm teaching small employers is the rate for roofing is not high because someone might fall off the roof. It's because they already did. That's experience. It's what's happened that drives the future rates. So when you isolate a single employer with a unique classification, the only thing they have to offset losses is the premium they pay. And I can see those rates becoming unaffordable very quickly.
Now, Jim, let me ask a question.
Mayor Schaffler.
Yeah, I understand the bearing rates, roofing, and all that. But what about Mr. Romaine's example of someone who sells beer on the phone and the person out there selling it and maybe delivering it, distributing it? Those are two different occupations completely. Now, yet, if I understand this correctly, they're classified under the same classification, but they're totally different job descriptions. So I'm struggling with how we can solve his problem and not create a unique classification and a self-insurance.
Chair Close, Representative Schaffler, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, we have done that sort of thing 150 times by saying we're going to treat that differently here in Oregon. Uh-huh. So we have that ability. But we did not ever say we're going to treat this employer differently, and that's what this bill says. This bill says John Booten Roofing, if he doesn't like the classification he has, can petition, and this bill gives the director the right to say, okay, we now have John Booten Roofing classification in Oregon.
Okay.
And I don't want to be there, and I don't want my small employers there either. I worry about them a lot.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
For the record, Chairman Close, Mike Taylor with NCCI. Just a specific on the appeal of the wine company. Oregon has a state special for beer and wine distributors. It's not a national classification. It was erected by an Oregon local committee made up of Oregon representatives of the insurance industry and employers and approved by the director of the DCBS. So it is a state special classification in itself. So it's already been created for the uniqueness of the wine and beer industry in Oregon.
Okay, John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today just to provide information on one part of HB 2952. The department is neutral on this bill, and you've already heard a lot from the other witnesses about the existing appeal process, and that's what I was here to just testify about today. We think it's important that the committee knows there is an appeals process available to an employer who disagrees with a rate classification. The first option typically is the employer can appeal directly to the insurance carrier, and if they're not satisfied with the insurer's division, then they can appeal to the Department of Consumer and Business Services as well as to the Oregon Rating Advisory Committee, which the other witnesses have talked about. The Oregon Rating Advisory Committee review provides the procedure for setting up new classifications or eliminating old, obsolete classifications if the evidence shows the need. And the current appeal process to the Insurance Division already provides the director with authority to review appropriateness of classification decisions. So, again, I'd be glad to answer any questions if I
may. Representative Kipps.
Madam Chair, I would like to ask Mr. Romaine, if he wouldn't mind, to come back up briefly and address this. I think it can be solved very simply. I think the concerns can be addressed.
Okay, we will intend to do that. We'll take our last two people testifying. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Davey and Lana Butterfield.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I'd just like to speak in support of the last panel of witnesses. Safe Corporation is opposed to this bill. This bill really addresses a unique situation that was presented to this ORAC committee, which I believe stands for Oregon Rating Advisory Committee. It's a committee that's made up of the regulator, DCBS, insurers, and employers, and that committee determined that that the existing classification was appropriate, and there is appeal being taken from that now. The director of DCBS affirmed the ORAC committee decision, and that case is still on appeal. I would also like to point out that the Management Labor Advisory Committee has not supported this bill, and it's really an issue of administrative efficiency as much as anything else. If every individual employer could bring individual facts to show that a classification doesn't exactly match their business, then instead of having 650 classifications in this state, who knows how many we would have. And so we are supportive of the previous testimony and opposed to House Bill 2952.
Thank you. Lana?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mona Butterfield. I'm here on behalf of Safeco Insurance Company, and we would like to place our opposition to this bill on the record. I don't have anything new to add to what my colleague has said. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we will bring Paul back up to address these concerns.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Romaine again. It's interesting. We're not trying to set up any new classifications for anybody. All we're trying to do is get people classified as they really should be classified, and we were trying to stay away from the particular case and use it as an example, but it is somewhat egregious. If there is a problem with the last line, 19 on page 3, creating a special classification, which I can understand, nobody's asking for a special classification, especially in a situation like this where there are existing classifications. We would just suggest that you take line 18A, ordering the application of another similar premium classification, and just move that into paragraph B, starting at 16, so you say if the director finds that a rate is unfairly discriminatory, under paragraph A of this subsection, the director shall mitigate the impact by ordering the application of another similar premium classification, period. In other words, you're not creating anything new. You're just saying, look, this is what happens if you find rates are unfairly discriminatory, which you already have language. I fail to understand what the objections are. You already have language in the statute that says rates are not to be unfairly discriminatory. We're on appeal right now because we felt this rate was unfairly discriminatory. We're winding our way through the process. We got the administrative law judge, which I might remind you is the only independent person to look at this besides industry. Independent person found that, yeah, it's unfairly discriminated against us. Went back to the agency and they said, no, we're going to, you know, we don't want to create anarchy out there. We're going to keep you in one classification because it's supposed to cover all salespeople, and you have some of your salespeople that naturally would be in this, so we're going to cover all your salespeople in this. I think you get around all the general problems of new rate classifications and everything else if you simply get rid of line 19. Just allow them, if they do find it to be unfairly discriminatory, to put some of these people into a different rate classification. No anarchy is intended.
Well, thank you very much. We're glad to hear that. Quickly, we need to move.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rosenbaum. Paul, I guess, though, I don't see what the bill would then accomplish, because if the director, the language still says if the director finds the rate is unfairly discriminatory, and I assume that's the basis of your appeal, and the director didn't agree, and now you're challenging that, and the ALJ agreed with you apparently at that level. So, why do we need it? I mean, what would this bill do that the present law does not require?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, it's really 17A. In other words, if that defines what unfairly discriminatory is. There's really no definition in the statute right now. B is simply the remedy, but A defines that if risks or hazard under a particular job classification descriptions that do not reasonably reflect the particular employer's operations or allocations of responsibilities. Currently, 7390, which is the general one, covers outside salespeople, and what the insurance is saying is that because it covers your outside salespeople, your inside salespeople are covered also, because since it covers some classes of salespeople, it has to cover all classes of salespeople. ALJ said that's unfairly discriminatory. Insurance said nope.
and passed it on. We would like to just put some standards. Would we win under this? I'm not really sure. It gives us, I think, a better chance, and we're not going to come to you and say we would we want you to mandate a particular rate, although we'd love it. But we felt that that would be a little bit of a burden on the legislative process, and I've been known to bring too many burdens to the legislative process as it is.
Thank you, Paul. We will expect amendments then for that bill.
Okay, thank you.
Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2952. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2925. Have the staff read the summary, and Jack Barnes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2925 allows insured to sign statement electing lower limits for uninsured motorist coverage within 60 days of making election. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jack Barnes, representing Farmers Insurance. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2925. Basically, what this bill does is establishes a time frame when a customer may sign an uninsured motorist waiver. Basically, what that is when a customer chooses to have auto liability limits, increase the auto liability limits, the uninsured motorist limits are also normally consistent with that. The customer also, though, has the option of keeping the minimum required limit should they choose to do so. If they do that, however, it's necessary that they sign an uninsured motorist waiver. Basically, that's a statement where they state that they want to have the lower limits. The problem that the insurers often have with that is that waiver is required to be signed at the point that the customer, in fact, elects to take the lower limits. And, excuse me, frequently in the business world anymore, a customer may not be in the agent's office to sign that. As a result, the insurance company is out of compliance because they don't have the signatures, at the point that the customer has decided to take the lower limits. What this bill does is give the insurer 60 days to obtain that signature. It basically doesn't really change anything within the system. I referred this to the Division of Insurance, and they were neutral on the issue, and so we'd request your support in passage of this bill.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much. That concludes our testimony on 2925. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2925.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2925 to the floor with the... Would it have a referral?
No.
With the due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2925 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Chopper?
Aye.
Representative Kitt?
Is excused.
Aye.
Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Schaffler, would you carry this bill for us?
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2925. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2717 and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2717 originally prohibits installing electrical product that is not certified, does not meet minimum safety standards. We have a -1 amendment in your packets, and it creates an exemption from certification for industrial electrical equipment, allows the board to remove exemption when a product is deemed a fire or life safety hazard, and expands methods by which an electrical product can meet safety standards. And the dash ones do replace the bill, but have the original bill incorporated. Thank you.
Well, we have a third of a page bill, which now becomes a very long bill. Mark Long. And I'll call Jared Broadfoot up as well.
Morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrative Building Codes, here to talk to you about 2717 with the -1 amendments. A little background. This bill primarily focuses on, in the amended version, on industrial electrical equipment. It's essentially the machinery that's used for the manufacture of products, such as the high-tech community, wind generation, a bunch of other things that we work with. The current regulatory framework treats industrial equipment the same as household appliances, which our experience has found creates confusion in the field. When does it need to be certified? When does it not? Who inspects? What are the processes? A lot of times this equipment is one of a kind, it's limited produce, and it's really maintained as part of the manufacturing process. This amended bill is the result of several work group meetings that we've had here recently between Building Codes Division and Industry, and I think folks will testify to that. It's also been an issue we've been working with between Building Codes and our State Electrical Board for the last couple years. These dash ones specifically in this bill clarify that the equipment that does not provide a life safety to a risk hazard to anyone is exempt from regulation. It goes into, and that's why there's so many pages, it provides additional options to regulate the equipment if there is a life safety hazard identified. And it provides directions to our inspectors and to the division so that when we are talking about life safety, we're focusing on grounding, bonding, and exposed life parts, really the core elements of public safety. We think this bill reduces the confusion that's out there currently and provides a clear framework for regulation of this kind of equipment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Let's go to Jared, and then we'll ask our panel question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfield with PacWest Communications. Up here now representing the National Electrical Contractors Association and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We also support the Dash 1 amendments to 2717. As Mark stated, this was a product of several work groups, and as the leaders in electrical safety, we wholeheartedly support this bill. I think it's due. We've been working on this for many years, and it's time that we dealt with this issue and deal with it correctly, and I think that's what we've done. So not to take any more time, I'll answer any questions.
Representative Garrard had a question.
I was just curious as to what type of electrical equipment is not a risk to life.
Chair Close, Representative Garrard. Again, this is dealing with workplace industrial electrical equipment, and the statutory framework under the Dash 1 basically assume that the equipment is monitored under a quality control or oversight process. It is also regulated by OSHA, federal OSHA standards. And then if there is a life safety problem, which what we're trying to clarify is exposed life parts where somebody could touch something that could be energized, whether it had overcurrent, the breaker, or whether it was grounded properly, if it upon inspection had those problems, then it would go through a process, a new process in this bill, that would allow it to come back into the fold of being safe. And there's six options we provided, where previously there was just two to regulate the equipment.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Steve Jackson, Precision Interconnect, and Jim Craven, and Nathan Phillips. Morning. Steve, why don't you go ahead?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. My name is Steve Jackson, representing Precision Interconnect. We're in Wilsonville, Oregon, a company of about 1,000 employees, so I would be a voice representing industry. Before we begin, I'd like to give my kudos and thanks to Mr. Mark Long, John Powell, Nathan Phillips for all the hard work they've done on this bill. We simply want to enter the record for supporting this bill, believing that it eases the burden of industries in certain respects and does a good job really in compromising the needs of industry and requirements of safety.
Jim?
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, nationwide high-tech trade association with 180 member companies here in Oregon. We, too, just want to give an attaboy to the work that all involved have done, including members from our industry, and support the Dash 1 amendments. I think it's this is a great example of, you know, there's a lot of talk about regulatory reform and setting up commissions to look at how to streamline rules and regulations. Well, here's an agency that's actually bringing you a solution rather than a task force. So we support the bill, and this has been many years in the making, and urge your adoption.
Thank you very much. Well, it's good to see so many people in agreement. And Nathan.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm chairman of the Electrical and Elevator Board and also an electrical contractor. I've encountered the area of the law that we're amending here both as
an electrical board member and also as an electrical contractor. We're frequently asked as contractors to connect equipment, and by equipment we're talking about process machinery, really, not electrical products in the sense that you normally think of them, that hasn't been certified, and we can't connect it because it doesn't meet the Oregon requirements. And when we talk to the manufacturers, they tell us that they sell this same equipment all over the country and that this is the only place where they run into this problem. And I think that as an electoral board member, I found that that is true, that we're one of a few states that has the level of regulation that we do here. The process that we've got today is unfairly and inconsistently applied. It really casts a net that catches the good guys and lets the bad guys go. And it's we've tried over the last several sessions to amend the statutes to tweak it so that it worked better, and it really hasn't been successful for various reasons. The cost of compliance for industry is high, and the value added is minimal, if any. This bill, as amended, represents the work product of the work groups that you've heard talked about, as well as the policy committee of the electrical board over the last really 4 years. So it's something that many stakeholders have had input into, and I think will remove some very difficult roadblocks for industry in our state. There are other processes that safeguard electrical equipment in the industrial workplace, particularly OSHA requirements and internal quality control processes. The board under this bill retains the authority to require certification if a hazard is found to exist. So I think that the workers and the workplace safety is protected in that way. So I would urge your support of this bill as amended. Thank you.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate how hard people have worked on this and come to a consensus. It really makes our job a lot easier. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Concludes our testimony on House Bill 2717, so I'm closing the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2717.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2717.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the -1 amendment into House Bill 2717. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum,
I would move House Bill 2717 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2717 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Is excused, excuse me.
Oh, here she comes.
Representative Gallegos, do you want to vote on this bill?
No.
After much serious deliberation and all the testimony that I heard,
it's a controversial one.
Yes, I think I'm going to vote aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Rosenbaum, would you carry the bill?
I'd be happy to.
Close the work session on House Bill 2717. Thank you, everyone. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3163, have the staff read the summary, and we will call forward Mark Long and Nathan Phillips.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3163 is a vehicle for the -1 amendment, so that's what's on your measure summary. It defines several terms, demarcation as well as the telecommunications service provided. It specifies that electrical safety laws do not apply to electrical installations and repairs of telecommunication systems provided by a telecommunication carrier or utility under certain circumstances. And it specifies that telecommunication work that is regulated under electrical safety law. Thank you.
Is there a presenter on the screen?
No.
Should I have some more?
Yeah. It's kind of a muddy look to get more
information. Okay.
As well as electrical guys right now.
Committee, this was another work group situation, so it's unclear who exactly is the spokesperson.
Shelley.
Okay. We'll call Shelley forward as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Close and committee members. I'm Shelley Jensen. I'm Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. I think this is a pretty straightforward bill, it arose because of an interpretive letter that we received from the chief electrical inspector, essentially saying that telecommunications providers needed to get permits for any telephone installations or repairs. And in meeting with the building codes folks, they essentially agreed that we probably didn't need permits for, you know, single line residential and small business and that kind of thing. But the way the code is written, there is no exemption for that. So this bill simply sets out a small exemption for certain residential properties and installations that are less than 10 outlets. So that would be in a very small business type setting. Anything that's a commercial setting would still require permits and inspections. And anything that would go through a firewall or any kind of hazardous materials also would require permits and inspections. We had a work group made up of building codes folks, the electric and elevator board, DEW, some independent electrical contractors, and it's my understanding that these amendments are the consensus of everyone, but I'll let Mark Long and Nathan give you their viewpoints as well. Thank you.
Mark?
Good morning again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long with Building Codes Division. I'll just add that this, again, is the product of a work group. We've been working on this issue for over a year. It's another area in our statute that's been confusing as far as what's to be regulated, how it's to be regulated. And this bill kind of complements some work that we worked on over on the Senate side under Senate Bill 822. This bill does three things. It recognizes equal regulation on the utility side, if you will, of telecommunications installation. Provides a bright line for when we're regulating, when we aren't. That's the demarcation point. And it clarifies to our comfort level when you need a permit and when you need a license for work on the customer side, just as Shelley indicated. So we think this goes a long way in cleaning up our statutory provisions, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
We'll take our last panel member, and then we'll go to questions.
Okay, my name is Nathan Phillips. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm chairman of the electrical board and also electrical and elevator board, also an electrical contractor. As Mr. Long said, this is another area of the statutes for the electrical safety law that's very confusing and inconsistent. It's pretty archaic. It dates back to the days of deregulation, and it doesn't really apply to today's world very well. This statute as amended really, or this bill as amended, really solves most of the problems that we've had at the electrical board with compliance and clarifying when permits and when licenses are required. I'd like to call your attention to one item on page 8, on line 29 of the bill, where we exempt the installation of patch cord and jumper cross-connected equipment on the customer side of the demarcation point. I want to enter into the record that by those words we mean plug-connected jumpers and patch cords. These are the cross-connect cords that you'll see in a wiring closet and not hard-wired cross-connect jumpers. I think that we'll see that question at the electrical and elevator board if this bill passes. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Questions on the bill? Okay, thank you very much. Call Mike Dooley. And Jared Broadfoot.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dooley. For the record, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, a trade association of Oregon cable companies. You have before you House Bill 3163. We do support that bill. It is a package. The other bill is Senate Bill 822, which is intended to treat competitive telecommunications providers essentially the same as the incumbent or telecommunications utilities under the Oregon Electrical Safety Law. That bill is intended to foster competition. When you get competition, you hopefully get better service and more opportunities in terms of the services delivered to you. I believe that bill will be on the Senate floor tomorrow. It came out of the Senate Consumer and Business and Consumer Committee. Let me say that we had intended originally to use 822 as the vehicle for also the language now in 3163, the amended language, but the legal counsel had opined that the relating clause was too narrow. So we have before you 3163, which is a good compromise because it clarifies what is very important, and that is the demarcation point from which you may need an electrical license or a permit. And we have not had that sort of delineation to this point. So we have before you a good compromise from the interested parties. It took some time to do that, and I want to thank and commend the Building Codes Division, Mr. Long, for getting us together. We had some interesting conversations, and I think we've come a long ways, and I didn't know if we could get there, but we have gotten there through 3163. So with that, I'll be quiet, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those questions.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Jared.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot of PacWest Communications, now representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. We do support the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3163 and would like to thank Vice Chair Kitts for allowing us to use House Bill 3163 as a vehicle. There was several work groups. Senate Bill 822 was supposed to be the vehicle, and due to the relating clause, we were forced to find another vehicle. This is a compromise, and we are happy with it. So with that, just urge your support. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. That concludes our testimony on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3163. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3163. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move we accept the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3163.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3163. Is there discussion?
No.
Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3163 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3163 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to commend the industry and the agency for working through these issues before they came to the committee. I can tell you that last session we used many, many hours of committee time to try to resolve technical issues that were way beyond our expertise, and this time it seems to have been worked out in advance, which is excellent. I'd also like to declare a potential conflict of interest, as I am employed by a telecommunications utility.
Thank you. Other discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Berkley?
Aye.
Representative
Chocolate?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Close? Both aye. Motion carries. And Representative Kitts will carry the bill. Closing the work session on House Bill 3163. Well, thank you, committee. We're working really well here. We just have one bill left on our schedule, and so I'm going to open a work session on 2649 and call Jim Welch. And the staff will refresh our memory on this bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2649 modifies the standards used to determine whether an individual business entity performs labor or services as an independent contractor. We have a Dash 1 amendment in your packets today that specifies an individual as an independent contractor if the individual is a home worker who meets four of the eight standards provided in statute and performs labor or services at a location in or near a rural unincorporated community, defines home worker as well as defines rural unincorporated community, and specifies that an independent contractor, as defined in this act, is not subject to workers' compensation.
Welcome.
Chair Close and committee members, I am Jim Welch, representing Oregon State Grange on House Bill 2649. As you know, from our original testimony, we were going to continue to work on this issue, and we have, but we're not quite there yet. The original bill and Dash 1 amendments, as I sent in a two-page note to the chair this weekend, either one of those do not take care of the problem at this point in time, as we understand. And we really want something that will be favorable to the committee and to those stakeholders around this issue. And it's a rather broad group when you start talking about ORS 670-600. And I've been involved in the Senate Bill 40 work group around this issue. House Bill 2989, representing Butler's bill, takes on the same issue, so there's been plenty of people at these meetings working on this. We understand that very possibly what we need to do for those individuals in Blatchley, Oregon, 80-plus individuals that want to be independent contractors, to take care of their problem there, we might have to have a different relating clause, as it boils down to at this point in time. So we will have another series of meetings here even this week in Salem to resolve this and come up with something hopefully that's going to be very positive for them. And I think the Oregon Employment Department is as committed as we are, is sitting at the table and working some details out. They certainly did that around the Senate Bill 40. Work group on Thursday, and so we're still hammering away here to take care of these issues. We were issued a letter, I should say Chair Close was issued a letter from the governor, but this was based on, you have to understand, this is based on the original bill and amendments, and Senate Bill 40 and House Bill 2989 ORS 670 approach. And our governor stated he was not inclined at the time to help in those matters if there wasn't something else done here, or at least the broad-based stakeholder groups got together and hammered some things out. So we're still in the work of progress. So I'm very encouraged at this point in time that we're going to have something here within a week or so, and very possibly bring it back to this committee, or it will be in another form with another relating clause.
Well, thank you, Jim, for working so hard on this and all the people that have been involved in this work group. I think it's an important concept, so we appreciate knowing your progress, and we will look forward to having you come back.
Thank you.
Okay, close the work session on House Bill 2649. And is there anything else for the good of the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.